On this episode of Balance and Manifest, Your Rise to Greatness, we sit down and talk with David Ireland. David is a neuromuscular massage therapist with a background in pain science and movement therapy. David walks us through the history and practice of neuromuscular therapy and how past traumas can affect you both mentally and physically. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to another episode of Balance and Manifest, Your Rise to Greatness, the podcast where our guests share their stories of overcoming hardship and fighting their way to success to help inspire and motivate others. I am your host, Sean.
And I'm Seth.
As always, guys, do us a favor. Whatever your podcast platform is, if you could like, follow, subscribe, listen to this episode, share it. And if you could, give us a rating so we can get this, we can climb up in the ratings, rankings, get this out to more people. And as always, this podcast is presented by Nine Realms Athletics. Follow Nine Realms Athletics on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and also ninerealmsathletics.com. Use promo code MANIFEST for a discount on your next order.
Woo!
All right, so today we are going to be talking about something that's, to me, unknown. It's a little more known to Savannah, and I think for the general public is a little unknown. That's going to be neuromuscular therapy. And to do that, we are talking to David Ireland. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I am absolutely fascinated by this topic. I've been really interested in it for a few years now, but it's one of those topics that it's new. I mean, do you know how long this has been kind of in the public eye as far as a therapy solution?
I think, my understanding of it is some of the early pain science stuff really started taking off in the late 70s, early 80s. And just with the matriculation of information, like now it's just coming to the forefront a little bit more, right? 20 years from clinical studies into a little bit more prevalent medicine. 20 more years for it to start getting more mainstream. So there's just a lot more push now, opioid epidemics and that kind of thing.
Oh, I know. Oh my God. Yeah. Insane what pharmaceuticals just get thrown at people these days.
Yeah.
It's pretty, I'm just going to say it, gross. Like there's so many other things that we can do for our bodies.
Sure.
I think it's as big a medical malpractice as In my eyes, as it can get, just throwing pills at things.
Well, it's just the understanding of it, right? If you're feeling pain, if you're having a pain experience, it really just becomes like, how do you help? And you know what they were taught was profitable, but it was literally just like, we got pills for it, and that's what we can do.
Yeah.
So
it's that easy fix.
Yeah.
So real quick, let's go into your background, your credentials. How long you've been in the business, how you got started in neuromuscular therapy, that kind of stuff.
Okay. I was a graduate of the National Holistic Institute, NHI, here in Petaluma. I attended there, started school there in 2011. So I've been in the industry 10-ish years. I went from their core program to their neuromuscular program that they offer in Emeryville and did that. And that's really my educational background for it. Then it's just all the additional CEUs and extra reading and everything you get on top of it. My interest in it really started from an injury I had in college playing football at Rose Holman. I was a biomechanical engineering major there. But I had a football injury where things just went wrong. My head hit the ground, and I had a whole bunch of offensive linemen land on me. And it was a good 6 months of learning how to use my arm again, getting like my walking down. I had issues with grip strength, and most of that plagued me for my adult life before I went to school. Even when I was in school, I had issues with it. And then I started deep diving into pain science and trying to get my arm to function better, trying to get things to just work better and not have the chronic headaches that I was always having. And that's when I started really diving into pain science and some of the neuromuscular end of things.
Where specifically did you have pain?
Where did I have pain? My left arm would go numb, my entire left arm. I would get blinding headaches. I would get so much discomfort in my left shoulder, where I was insistent that something was wrong with my left shoulder. My elbow felt like it was swelling all the time. I couldn't find a comfortable place for my shoulder just to rest. I couldn't lay on my shoulder. I couldn't lay on my back. A lot of things I couldn't do, mm-hmm. or felt like I couldn't do. And just had a lot of issues with it.
And what was the consensus of the injury itself? Like, what was the injury itself?
So initially it was looking at, they weren't quite sure. They were like, oh yeah, there's radiculopathy. We'll see what happens later on. And as I was having more issues with my shoulders into my adult life, I was like, something's going on with it. Eventually they started doing myographs and seeing what was going on. And they realized that I had cervical stenosis from C4 to T1. So a lot of issues going on with the nerves. Apparently my right side is technically worse, but my left side is more symptomatic, which again, like there's a lot that you can pick apart over that. But yeah, that's basically it. Mm. Blinding headaches, all that kind of stuff.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So I'm the, I was telling you leading up to this, I'm kind of the resident lay person. So what is stenosis?
Stenosis. So when we look at our spine, our spine has these openings on the side of it where the nerves come out from the spinal cord. And I was having the channels of those can actually fill with bits of debris, scar tissue, that kind of stuff. And those channels can narrow, impinging on the nerves. So it's basically like a pinched nerve, but at the nerve root.
Now, is that generally from a specific incident, or is that something that usually happens over time, like a buildup, or can it?
It can be both.
Vary?
Yeah, vary. It can be both.
Okay.
With you, was it more immediate because of the injury itself?
I think for mine it was a bit of both. Right, mm. There was the initial bit of like inflammation and everything else, and then as I was still trying to be an active adult doing things. I think there were times when I had pushed my body a little too far. Mm. And so it was just one of those things where I probably injured myself multiple times. There's no good way of knowing, right? Like unless you're doing imaging day after day after day to see any sort of progression,
right?
Then you're never going to know the answer.
Right. And there's so little we know about the brain itself, let alone our central nervous system.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like you said, if you're not doing it all the time, you're not going to know.
Well, there's a lot that goes into that with any sort of condition that we see, right? When we get someone that has an injury of some sort, we always think that there has to be a defining moment when the injury happened, but we have to understand that. We don't know when the injury actually happened. We don't necessarily know when something gave way or something was sprained or a ligament tore. We don't always know when it actually happens. Mm. Because there's some wonderful statistics about degeneration or injury, not equivocating to a pain experience. Mm. So just because you have pain now doesn't mean it's to any sort of injury you currently have.
Okay.
Yeah.
So looking through your journey, you're experiencing this pain. What was kind of the turning point of like, okay, I need to venture out into figuring out how to take care of this?
I had a physical medicine doctor in Kaiser in San Rafael who literally was like, look, your stuff is not going to get better. Like we can keep imaging, we can keep talking about it. You're not a surgical fix. Like we could fuse your spine, but you know you're
That's
not going
to the solution.
Yeah, like you don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
So we and I really like that approach that he was like, we need to figure out how to make you work right.
That's refreshing.
Yeah. And that was different. Everyone, you know, you deal with people in holistic medicine or even Western medicine where everyone offers you a solution of like, we will take care of it for you. And he was straightforward and was like, you have to figure this out for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there to support me. Like he answered emails when I had questions and really just kind of gave me some oversight as I was starting to pick things apart a little bit.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, it was nice to have.
So how did you get from, okay, this is my roots. How did you get from those roots of, okay, I have this injury and going into the discovery of neuromuscular therapy?
So I think at first it was trying to find a fix. It was going to chiropractors and acupuncturists and fixes. Anything I got was temporary. Nothing was a fix. It was all like, here's a Band-Aid for a little bit. And that was super frustrating. I started reading some articles on actual pain science, more particularly with like the San Diego Pain Summit, which happens every February down in San Diego, where it's a group of neuroscientists, physical therapists talking about what is a pain experience, mm-hmm. and really seeing their ideas and being like, well, none of this stuff is working. None of it.
Yeah.
So let's embrace these ideas. Let's look at what the science actually backs, what it says works and doesn't work, and work within that frame to try and make something different happen. Mm-hmm. And that's really it. You know, change any part of the input, you have an opportunity to change the output of the experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you currently deal with those injuries now that it's been so many years later?
Now that it's so many years later, it's amazing to me how functional I am. I still struggle with things now and again. Like I still have to, when I lift weights, which I can actually do, I there are times when my arm goes numb or I lose coordination when I lift overhead. So I still have issues with it now and again, but it really is just like mentally flipping the switch, right? Like it's understanding what's going on, understanding that it's not catastrophic. It's not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. I know how to get things back and kind of almost talking myself off of the ledge, right? Because I think a lot of times with injuries, when we start having a pain experience, we catastrophize it.
Yeah.
This is the end. I can't keep doing this. All of those things. And once you have some better coping skills in place, then I think it becomes easier to deal with.
Yeah, kind of going in the path of least resistance.
Yeah, that's huge because I know when I had my injury years ago, that's what led to my obesity was injured back. Doctor says you're not going to, you probably shouldn't do X, Y, Z. And I was too scared to do it. I was 19 years old or 20 years old and didn't know any better. And then I was sedentary and just was too scared to get hurt. And what I found was being inactive made it worse. And I finally, I don't know, maybe it was 8 years later or so, 7 years later, was if I sit at home, I'm going to hurt. If I go to the gym, I'm going to hurt. At the time, I didn't know the hurt at the gym would subside. And it would get worse before it got better because it's strengthening core and all those kind of things. But it's going to hurt either way. So I might as well figure out how to be active and change and do something about it.
Absolutely. I think oftentimes when we look at some of the movement science behind things, like movement is what provides feedback to the nervous system, right? The more you move, your nervous system adjusts to the stresses that are put on you. It gets feedback on what's going on from the environment. How do you feel? All of that. So movement becomes like proof that we're safe, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term, that we're safe in our body. And by subjecting it to exercise stress, controlled environments, as long as we're not going off the deep end with it, controlled environments, we actually can modulate the stress that we expose ourselves to. And when we start seeing positive feedback or get positive feedback from the stresses that we're undergoing, it actually is soothing to our nervous system. We learn to not send out a pain signal. And that's an important, it's an important thing to grasp is that most pain is output. It's not input. It's not the stress we're exposed to. It's how we interpret the stresses around us. And if we interpret those things as to be dangerous, then we don't feel safe. And if we don't feel safe, our nervous system has a chance to send out a pain signal just to get us to change something in our environment. Mm. Obviously, it can't tell us what, but change something. Here's pain. You're going to have pain until you change something.
And it's just you trying to figure out what that something is.
And it could be anything, yeah. Right? And I think that's the frustrating part. It's the amazing part, and it's the frustrating part all at the same time. Because it could be something as basic as like changing your shoe, changing the color of your hair, changing mm-hmm. any little thing has an opportunity to have this cascading effect of changing what a pain experience is for you.
It's very interesting. So I think that's a good segue into what is neuromuscular therapy?
So it's a combination of things, right? With what I was taught, it was taught as a massage modality, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to dig into trigger points. We're going to look for these hyper irritable knots, and we're going to try and get them to release. And that's only a small part of it. Like even the experts can't really agree what a trigger point actually is. So there's no real proof of concept to that.
I was just reading on the term release.
Yeah.
It's not even used anymore because they can't prove that it releases.
Yeah. And that's important, right? And I think it's a failure of the education in a lot of holistic health that they don't introduce new knowledge like that.
Right.
They cling to these old, outdated beliefs, and it perpetuates false information.
Right.
Right. So it makes people think that, so, oh, someone has to release this. No, that's not how it works. That's not how any of it works. So like, yeah, a little bit of novel feedback to the nervous system might help you, mm-hmm. but it really is becoming like, address your stresses. Like, let's figure out what's actually going on with you.
Right.
And look at what are your coping skills around it.
Yeah.
And kind of talk you off the ledge, work on some coping skills, work on identifying what your stresses are, and get some movement going in your life. And that's really what I try and incorporate. It's the ideas of the biopsychosocial model of a pain experience.
Okay. So just kind of putting it in my own terms, it's essentially life having an effect on the body and the body showing the history of your own life history, essentially, where is your body is compensating for the effects of the stress. Is that kind of...
Well, I think sometimes a language becomes so challenging, right? Compensation isn't a dirty word, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of times we're like, oh, we're compensating for this, and now that's everything.
Yeah, talking to a client, that's going to seem like a pretty derogatory word.
Yeah, and it's not. Like, compensation is your body's attempt to get out of a pain experience. Mm-hmm. It's trying to do something different in a safe manner. And
right.
And with that, it doesn't have the same tolerance. Like if you have something going on with your leg, you feel pain in your leg, you're going to adjust the way you walk. You're going to recruit muscles differently.
Correct.
And then we have to look at that being like, that's your body's attempt to not experience pain, mm-hmm. right? Your brain doesn't want to do that, but that's what it's going to do. It's going to make these adjustments. So how it's recruiting things is going to not have the same tolerance as what you normally do. You're changing your movement pattern.
Right.
So everything is new. Once you build up the neural pathways again, maybe adjust a little bit of strength, that new way of walking might be normalized a little bit more for you.
Mm-hmm.
But until it is, you're not going to have the same confidence in movement. And you might even be self-conscious about how you're moving. Are people looking at you funny? Like any of those things also play into what your pain experience is. Because if everyone's looking at you, maybe you're self-conscious about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So looking at neuromuscular therapy, neuromuscular therapy in an isolated fashion, how is it different from, say, like active release therapy or trigger point therapy?
So I think it's how much it encapsulates, right? Everyone in like ART or massage, they're always like, oh, we have to, again, release these muscles.
Yeah.
Right? If we understand what we're doing, like most of it is just novel sensation. If we provide novel sensation to an area, mm-hmm. feedback. If we provide feedback to an area and take it through some basic ranges of motion, we have a chance to change a pain experience, particularly if someone is doing it to us. If you allow me to touch you, that is one of the ultimate expressions of I am safe because I am allowing this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at massages, things like that, they tend to happen in a low stimulation environment, soft music, dark room. And you can just focus on like, there's a hand here that isn't mine. I can't control the pressure. I can't control what they're going to do. And I feel safe. That de-escalates the nervous system mm-hmm. after about 20-ish minutes, can de-escalate the nervous system. And we have an opportunity to change the pain experience. That's temporary. If we want to make it long-term, it becomes more like, now we can identify stresses. We can make maybe some positive changes in your life. That borders on therapy. And I have to be really careful with my scope of practice
totally.
On that. And then we can introduce like some movement and exercises. And again, being mindful of scope of practice on that.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to embrace all of that to try and make a person just feel better and understand that we all struggle. Progression isn't linear.
Absolutely.
You're going to have days that are good, days that are bad.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that. And a lot of times, I think even with some of the stigmas in mental health, we're taught not to talk about that.
So back to what you were saying with your doctor, with your injury.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a neuromuscular therapy is like a team effort. right? It's like this person has pain and you have your scope of, say, massage, but then you're, because it can be triggered by a certain event, like a mental issue, or not issue, but like pain, trauma.
Yeah.
So then you're incorporating, could incorporate psychological therapy.
Sure.
And so it's a multi-prong approach to, okay, my leg hurts, but it might not just be your leg. There's other things. So this is like a big, it's a team effort of attacking to fix the problem.
I would hope it's a team effort.
Okay.
I think if any one person tells you they have all the answers, they're gonna try and sell you a program on something and make money off of you. Mm-hmm. It should be a team effort. So when we talk about neuromuscular therapy, we talk about any of the neurotherapy stuff, we have to understand that our brain is constantly learning, good and bad. And there are times if we have had pain for a particular amount of time, usually it's like 2 to 3 months. If we've had pain for a certain amount of time, our brain will learn to preemptively give you a pain signal, mm-hmm. because that's what it knows and that's its new baseline. So there's a lot of times we have to deep dive in chronic pain to really identify what's going on with us mentally, because the stimulation is no longer there. The dangerous environment is no longer there. Why does my ankle hurt that I rolled 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. Your brain learned to put pain there just as like a warning, a little just like, be careful, because you hurt this once and you could hurt it again. So sometimes we have to dive in to see like what was going on 20 years ago and really figure that out.
Gotcha.
And yeah, so the deep dive gets really hard because it forces us to face a lot of parts of ourselves that we don't always want to re-experience.
Absolutely. So you're looking at the psychological trauma that your brain remembers first, and then fixing the body.
Yeah. And like I said, the body stuff is really like, it's a Band-Aid. Like, you're going to feel good for a little bit. It's a Band-Aid. You get people that'll swear by it, and that's fine. But at the same time, like, long term, really, to be kind of that healthier, happier person, it's going to figure out like what are your underlying causes of all of this?
Right.
And really trying to address those.
Yeah, totally. What are, I was very curious, are meridians a part of the practice as well? Like, just kind of mapping out the meridians themselves?
So you're talking like Eastern medicine meridians?
Correct. Yeah.
Like Chinese medicine?
Yeah.
So yes and no, right? So we can look at different modalities, right? Eastern massage, any type of like shiatsu follows the 12 meridians. And if you look at like Thai massage, they follow their stylized bit of meridians. When you start looking at kind of what they do, there's a pretty big overlay to the position of meridians and where you find trigger points, mm-hmm. on the body, right? If you look at how they map out. And to me, really, the best explanation I've been given is it's more about nerve shear. You have nerves that are closer to the surface on those spots.
Right.
So they're almost always slightly more tender, slightly more sensitive, because mm-hmm. there's a nerve right there,
yeah.
a little bit closer to the surface.
Yeah.
So there is overlay. You see it system across system across system, but I don't think the meaning is there, right? Like, to me, if you're going to swallow that pill, you have to swallow all of the pills that are involved with it, right? Like, if you're talking energy meridians, then you're talking about, like, I can fix this hangover by holding this one spot on my foot. Or I can eliminate a pregnancy by holding this spot on my hand, because it's the great eliminator. Like, to me, if you're going to buy into meridians, where do you draw the line on what you're buying into?
I getcha. I see.
So what is a meridian?
So the way I've understood it, just through my own research, is that it's their energy pathways, essentially, through the top to the bottom of the body. So you can see, those maps of feet all the time where it's, or like somatosensory, where there's the map of the foot of like, this is the intestines, this is this, and this is that. It's like, okay, there's points in the body. Okay, for perfect example for you to understand, when you went to therapy for your back, and so you have your back injury, you can't walk, you're stiff, all these things, and you're like, I can't walk across this room. I can't believe you're trying to make me walk across this room. And she grabs that part of your hand, and then all of a sudden you can walk fine across the room. That's a meridian.
It's the idea that our body, all of our body parts are connected.
Essentially.
Right. It kind of.
In a way.
In like a basic term, like people always say, oh, your headache, you have a headache in this part of your head. Well, that could be because, you know, pressure here. So they'll massage your hand in a certain spot and it might relieve. So it's just the nerves that are interconnected through different parts of the body, essentially.
Kind of, yes. So like even something as basic as like, and not that it's basic, but a headache and getting a hand massage, right? That is novel feedback to your hand that mm-hmm. may cause your nervous system to de-escalate and make your headache go away. I think some of the things that we start talking about with meridians, that makes it a little bit more advanced, right? When we start looking at meridians, there's colors that are associated with meridians. Mm. There's emotions associated with meridians. It becomes this whole cycle of things where it's like, again, where do you draw the line?
Right.
If you just look at saying like these points exist along the same pathway that a nerve recruitment pattern may exist, mm-hmm. to me, that makes a lot more sense. Cause like if we're talking chi and all this other kind of stuff and energy meridians, like we can't prove any of that.
Right.
And maybe it exists, maybe it doesn't. Right. You will anger some people by saying none of that exists. Yeah. But at the same time, like give me something, anything to give me a little bit of proof that we're on the right path.
Yeah,
with
it's
that.
More getting to the more clinical side of things.
Yeah. And yeah. I like the things that we can prove. Right. We can look at totally. some of the history and resurgence of Chinese medicine and what that meant politically in China in the 1950s, mm-hmm. Which is its own kind of scandalous thing with like the rise of Mao Zedong and communism. There was a reason Chinese medicine had a resurgence at that time. And that was a government that didn't want to provide healthcare for its people. Embrace your cultural roots, come back to these things that are 2000 years old and embrace what it means to be a good Chinese person.
Oh, I see.
And so it became more about one, not spending the money to actually take care of your people. Mm. And just being able to put all that aside, embrace your cultural roots again, mm. right? So you get the sense of patriotism going back into it. And yes, there are some medicines in Chinese medicine that do have medicinal effect and can help people, mm. but let's identify those and study those in a more clinical setting to make it more effective instead of just boiling it into a tea and hopefully it works.
Yeah, well, and it's a lot easier to explain to clients, right, when it comes to credibility and what you're doing with their body, essentially. Yeah. So I really want to get into, once you get through those actual psychological blockades with your clients and you get to the actual body work part of it, mm-hmm. how do you map out your process in getting more relief with their pain?
So I think a lot of it is reading the person. Again, this is going to make people angry. 80-ish% of manual therapy is placebo. I have no problem saying that.
Okay.
70-80%. So if we look at that, it really is just like, does the person you're seeing feel heard? If I start rubbing your foot when you tell me your back hurts, right, you may have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. If I spend the whole time doing energy work on your feet, you may have a problem with that. Right. So it really becomes like, let's address the areas that you feel and let's just try and get you to calm down.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, a lot of people are like, the pain is here. So the problem is here.
Right.
Well,
right. And it doesn't have to be, right?
Right.
Like it can be anywhere along the lines. We can talk about, again, compensation and different stress patterns. Like if you've changed a movement pattern recently, yes, your shoulder may hurt. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your shoulder. It just means that your shoulder hurts as it's trying to build a different movement pattern.
Right.
And it really is just getting people kind of talking off the ledge. Like we can introduce orthopedic tests, not always accurate, but we can introduce orthopedic tests to kind of prove to someone, like particularly with like a knee, that like, oh, something's going on with my knee. Cool. Let's test all the ligaments in your knee and we can prove to you that nothing is probably wrong. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the meniscus in your knee and prove that nothing is probably wrong. Let's do some exertional tests and see if nothing is probably wrong.
Yeah.
Right. If we can't replicate the pain or if we can't show any sort of issue, is there anything wrong? Well, you're still experiencing pain and I believe you. But let's just actually get you to calm down a little bit, right? Mm. And then it's, you know, let's get some movement in there because you're probably not moving it because you think something might be wrong or you're worried about how it's going to affect your future doing certain things. And it literally just, let's talk the person off the ledge, make them feel heard, give their nervous system some feedback that is slightly different from what they're used to, mm-hmm. and their brain has a chance to make a different decision moving forward of, do we experience pain or do we not send out a pain signal?
I see. So you know that the tissue is not injured, but essentially it's walking through them, convincing them that the tissue is not injured and they don't have injury, but then getting to the pain part of it and the nerve part of it.
Well, and I can't even say the tissue isn't injured. I can make a best guess, but, and I have to be really honest with people. Like, I don't know. I can't.
Right.
Like visually, I can look at it and be like, it's not swollen, it's not red, it's not inflamed, but I don't know for sure.
Do you refer people out to go get tests done and then come back?
Absolutely. If and I think it's one of the ethical dilemmas that we face in what we do. If I don't think I can help you, I will send you away to someone else.
Yeah.
I will be like, nothing I can do.
Yeah.
Because there are times when people have come to me with things where I'm like, that is way beyond what I can deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll still want to see me. And that's fine as long as I've been ethical and upfront with what I can help you with.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be people that will see you regardless of what you have going on. And I don't think that's necessarily ethical.
I've been in that same scenario as a personal trainer,
yeah.
where I have a client that has so many muscular imbalances from certain stressor compensation, or I say the word compensations, but... it muscular imbalance is that she can't, her skeletal system is not functional to do the movements properly in order to strengthen the muscles that she needs to strengthen. So it's like, okay, I need you to go out and get these taken care of, come back to me.
Well, and I think even that, I think there's a place for that, right? I think, so I've been reading a whole bunch of NASM stuff and looking at possibly becoming a trainer myself,
mm-hmm.
but I'm having issue with how things are written, right?
Totally.
Like even the idea of like a muscular imbalance. Is it really an imbalance or is it just a pattern that you've developed, right? Because that's really what your brain wants. Your brain becomes more efficient at the things you do most often.
Right.
So if you sit all the time, it's not that your hip flexors are necessarily tighter than anything. You've just developed this pattern. Get up and move a little bit more and your hip flexors will break out of that pattern.
And we have this conversation all the time when it comes to injuries, because, and it's this battle back and forth of like, okay, do you fix those quote unquote imbalances so you can have a perfect anatomical structure,
which doesn't exist.
Okay. And when you say I'm having trouble with the verbiage, I'm doing my corrective, cert right now with NASM.
Right.
And there are times where I read it and I'm like, okay, but if that's how they function, that's how they function.
Right. And to me, it's seeing, Australia's been really big on producing some of these studies, but you'll see them periodically in out of other countries. But you look at some people, like I was looking at runners and there is I want to say Kenyan, I could be completely wrong with that, but a female marathon runner from Kenya who, when she runs, she does an egg beater motion with her leg.
Mm.
Like they flare out to the side.
I've seen that with runners.
And it's ugly, but that's what she knows.
Right.
And she's one of the fastest women on the planet. Like
don't mess with that.
Right. Like if you mess with that, you have a chance of completely changing her movement pattern and it may affect her speed. Right. And just understanding that her nervous system knows how to do things a very specific way. And that's what it does.
Yeah.
Right. Even Usain Bolt, he's got scoliosis and he's got one leg that's shorter than the other one. He's one of the fastest men on the planet.
Yeah.
If you say it has to be this very specific way, that's not true. It's just this is how he has trained and developed his entire life.
Right. When I think about like, because the big talk with those sorts of things where, you know, someone's leg might be shorter than the other,
yeah.
or these little quote unquote, it's a horrible word to use, but it's the word that will come up a lot is imperfections.
Yeah.
It's okay. Then how in the argument that is always told, like you need to have your body be this way or else you're going to get injured.
Well, I think if again, Sean,
yeah,
like
yeah.
I'm
an open book.
What's your deadlift, man?
About 589.
589. Right. Like how long did it take you to get to 589?
I've been lifting for what? 7 years,
right?
8 years,
right? And I think that is the issue. Is I think people want their fix now.
Mm. Yeah.
Seven years of lifting is a grind that most people will not get through. Like, even now, I'm plateauing on my deadlifting, pushing 300, just over 300 pounds. And it is killing me mentally seeing that.
Yeah.
And to sit there and be like, I've got six more years before I can hit a number that I feel is respectable. If we listen to every part of that conversation, all of it is about my internal dialogue. Mm-hmm. Nothing is about doing the actual work to get there. Right. And I think that's where people fall off on some of the things, right? Like, it takes years to get really good at something.
Yeah.
Years and years. And most people will never put forth the effort to actually get really good at something.
Well, and even getting to that level,
yeah,
you're not looking at 5 pound, 10 pound increments anymore. You're looking at half pound,
2 pounds here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that positive self-talk is insanely important when it talks about getting in that process. And that's that mental mind body connection, mm-hmm. where if you don't have the mind in it, your body's not going to do it.
Well, and again, with like the idea of a mind body connection, we also have to look at childhood development, because that is what shapes our mind body connection, right?
Absolutely.
Early childhood coping skills are what, 4 to 12, something right around
there,
right? So all the modeled behavior that your parents give you from that age really determines how you begin interacting with the world. Right. Mm-hmm. Then at about 12, you start really kind of pushing boundaries a lot more, trying to get, again, feedback socially on what works and what doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when some people run into trouble, because what their parents showed them, the reality is that doesn't actually work in life.
Yeah.
So the coping skills that you're taught from early childhood is going to shape your ability to push past some of that.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of times for me, when I start coming across like some of the mental roadblocks of looking at what my training is going to look like now and what it is progressing into, I literally have to talk myself off that ledge of like, just show up, just show up one day at a time, keep doing the work, keep being safe with what you're doing. You'll see the progress that you want. And that is a far cry from how I was raised.
Mm.
I was raised either you succeed or don't even try.
That's like kind of how I was raised.
Yeah,
also.
and we have to understand that like that's not a healthy way to raise someone. And
creates
so
a crippling fear of failure.
Right, an absolutely crippling fear of failure. So we look at something like my shoulder injury, where that ended my father's dream of me playing football in college. Right,
mm-hmm.
And so it becomes all of these things wrapped up into that, and until I actually dug into that, I had no chance of actually recovering from my injury.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, I'm glad you brought this up, because in this line of work, in your line of work, mm-hmm. in my line of work of, you know, just therapy and personal training in general, people don't realize how, and I'm using the word intimate as a term where you find things out about people that people wouldn't otherwise tell most people in their lives.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't think a lot of clients coming into personal training or bodily therapy realize that that's something that needs to be shared. And sometimes actually just naturally comes out, in the practice itself. And they go, I feel so much better.
Yeah.
Like just for example, my client told me, you know, this is the first time in my life that I actually like the way my arms look. And it's like, that you've gone your entire life with an insecurity, which now, you know, a third of the way through your life, you're just accepting yourself.
Well, and I deal with that, right? Like I deal with that all the time.
Totally.
Even so, I mean, you guys know, but I do a ton of jiu-jitsu and a ton of grappling, and I'm a pretty decent sized person, but I constantly look at myself as being still the fat kid. Mm. My arms are too small. I'm not strong. And I look at what I've been able to accomplish in my life, and it's, you know, at the evidence, I look at that and say, none of that is true.
Right.
But the innate feeling is like, I still have that. And even dealing with Rob, my trainer, I literally sat him down one day and was like, do I have your permission to be strong? Because the way he was treating me was still with my injury. And there were times when I felt I could push more and I didn't want to overstep my boundaries of actually pushing. But I was at a point of like, I want this now. I want to push.
Yeah.
So with your permission, because I still felt I needed that, I want to be strong. So, mm-hmm. so let's go.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing to start really learning yourself mm-hmm. and what triggers you and what doesn't trigger you. Your triggers will still always be there. It's about how triggering are they, what you feel you need kind of permission to do to be authentically yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. It's a real challenge. And you constantly run up against it every day.
Yeah, I think the worst thing that people can do is just not face it. And I did that. I did that for a long time, is not facing it. And there's a path of healing to where you can help cope with those things. But like you said, they never really go away, but just become mild.
Yeah, it's just less, right? And it becomes what are your coping skills that you rely on? Like yeah. some people rely on drugs and alcohol to get them through the day, right? Like right. that's just what some people do to cope. So yeah. some people turn to whatever to just get through the day because they don't want to face who they are. And really it's starting to understand too that like your actions have to line up with your words,
right? Right.
You have a lot of people that'll talk their game. That'll be like, I want to do these things. What actions are you taking to actually do those things?
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. That's and it's hard, right? What is the support around you when you're actually trying to do that? Like, yes. do we have to address the, you may want to do it, but fear is holding you back. How can we address that fear? How can you feel loved and supported mm-hmm. and understand that you still might fail at times, but you still have to keep pushing for what you want?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm glad that kind of translates through in this as well. Cause we deal with that a lot in just the gym itself and teaching people. I mean, when it comes to teaching people, what can people do to, obviously you have your practice here, but just giving a little snippet of maybe something that people can do on their own if they're experiencing pain. Cause a lot of people feel like they need the tools and things like that, but it's almost like it's unattainable.
I think with a lot of it, it becomes, you have to find out where you're at. You have to find out where you're at and you have to meet people where they're at. So like some people will still foam roll, right? Mm-hmm. And if that's what you need, then that's what you need. But you need to eventually be independent of that.
Right.
You need to eventually move away from that.
Totally.
You need to try things without that. It's just finding that spectrum and really pushing yourself constantly to do more, to do more with less, to be self-reliant, self-sufficient.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that in an isolationist sort of way, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, it's you. Like you have to do you.
No one's going to take care of you.
No one's going to take care of you the way you necessarily need them to, right?
Correct.
The idea is like you put your happiness in someone else's hands, they'll drop it every time.
Yeah, yes.
Right? So just understanding that you intimately know what you want. Like
right.
You may be afraid to vocalize it to someone else, but you know what you want. You know what you need. And it's figuring out, if we start talking about like parenting your inner child, like that's what you have to do at times is mm-hmm. just be like, okay, am I okay? What am I actually struggling with? How do I meet this need? Is it just like, for me, a lot of times it's just like kind of reevaluating what are the lies I'm telling myself
mm-hmm.
and really seeing like, am I sincere with what I want? Am I really working towards the goals that I want? What is getting in my way? Like mm-hmm. you can literally do like pro-con lists. What am I really struggling with?
Yep.
Trying to identify what the emotions are, trying to identify and come up with a plan of like, well, this is what I'm feeling. Okay. This isn't true. These are the reasons this isn't true. Okay, let's try and move past that. It's still going to sting a little bit, but let's figure it out.
Yeah.
But I know that this isn't true because of all of this evidence contrary to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes people have a hard time even knowing to question whether it is the truth or not because they've been told for so long to be a certain way or this is a certain way or...
Well, I think that even plays into with injury ideas, right? Like if someone's like, oh, you can't do that, you've got scoliosis. Eventually, if you hear that enough times, you're going to stop doing that and you're going to use scoliosis as a cop-out.
Right.
And like there were times in my life with my shoulder and my neck and everything else where I didn't want that to be a cop-out anymore.
Yeah.
I used it. There were times I absolutely used it. I don't want to do something. Suddenly my neck starts to hurt. Cool. Did I talk myself into that? Was my neck actually hurting?
Mm.
Who knows? But I was using it as a cop-out to not take chances.
Yeah.
If gives you a reason. 7 years in the weight room is hard to do. And if you have a reason to quit, there are a lot of people that will take that. and they will take the out.
That's the easy. It's the easy way out.
It's the easy way out.
The constant,
right?
The constant pain and the work and the struggle and the fight. And sometimes it's just easier to go, yeah, I'm not going to do that.
I'm just not going to do that.
Well, yeah. It's funny because you hear a lot of people who have been in the gym for a long time just go, oh, just no excuses. But this is a sort of very harsh, but I just through what we've been talking about, this is almost like a clinically proven and progressively being proved that you don't need excuses.
No, take the day off.
Yeah.
There are days you need to sit down and do nothing. Like recovery is where you actually build muscle and strength.
Yeah.
Like take the day off.
Yeah.
I think, again, looking at coping skills, how was someone raised? Mm. Right. How was someone raised? Were they taught that they can't ever take the day off? Is the person's only sense of value what they accomplish in the day?
Yeah.
Some days.
Or someone else telling them that they're doing a good job.
Right. And I've had days like that. I've had days where I'm like, Rob, hurt me because I need to feel like I have accomplished something today.
Yeah.
I've had those days. And that's really like own it. Just own it and understand like, okay, I'm struggling with a lot of things right now. And this is what I need. I need my dopamine hit. I need my serotonin hit. How do I get those?
Yeah.
And still feel like I'm accomplishing things in life. Still feel like I'm accomplishing things. Like it's my small little win. And there are days where it's like, don't want to do this. And I'm not going to beat myself up for it because I know I'm going to go back to it. The more critical I am of myself while I still want the growth, mm-hmm. the more critical and hard on myself, I have to, again, look at how was I raised? Is it me just not wanting to do something? Is it the kind of the voice of my parents harping on me for like, you need to be doing more, you need to be doing better, right? The inner critic is usually the voice of our parents, right? So we have to look at that in addition to it. And we're always going to second guess kind of what we're doing, right? Am I not going into workout today because of X, Y, and Z? Is it authentic? Is that exactly who I want to be today?
Yeah.
Or is it my parents harping on me?
And yeah, it's just that constant knowledge and self-reflection of your own self.
And I think the self-reflection is important.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of people skip out on that. Or maybe they don't. Maybe it's, you know, deep down late at night, they worry about all the things. But I see a lot of people that kind of don't look at themselves critically, right?
I always look at it as like, there have been, I know it's not true because everyone can choose to do it, but it's like, sometimes I've thought like, do people just have that where they just choose to self-reflect or is it something that someone just has of like, okay, this happened. I'm going to analyze this to the point where I need to put it on myself and feel it and see what they went through. And then how would I deal with that?
I think it's a spectrum. I think it's absolutely a spectrum, right? It becomes what motivates you. Mm. There's a lot of times that I just want to be better as a person.
Totally.
I want to be able to show up for the people around me in my life. So I do want to be more introspective, but you get some people that are introspective because society told them to be, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I never thought about it that way.
Well, you get people like, oh, you know, you should look at your behaviors, and they're going to be like, you're right, I should look at my behaviors. Well, do you actually want to look at your behaviors? Like, most people don't.
Right.
Most people don't want to own their mistakes. They don't want to do that. That doesn't feel good internally a lot of times.
No one likes being wrong.
Yeah. So, and we're wrong a lot. So we have to understand that, like, yeah, let's be self-reflective, but like, what is our motivation to be self-reflective?
Okay. Yeah. Right?
I want to show up as a better person in anyone around me's life. Like, that's what I want to be.
Yeah.
And it really is almost like creating my own mission statement of like, do I feel this communication has gone off the rails? How do I rectify this?
Yeah.
And I have to understand that if it's a communication with another person, I don't have control over that. Like, I can express myself. They still may not hear it.
Yeah.
I can express myself. They may not accept it. And I have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
So I think that it becomes like, how triggering is all of that to me, right? I express myself, do all those things. And that lets me know, am I authentic? Am I forgiving myself? Because if I start spinning out of control, full of anxiety over things, well, then I'm not being authentic. I'm not.
Yeah, like that, thinking too far ahead.
Yeah, like then I'm not living in the moment. I'm not doing any of those things. So there are times when you have to kind of rein it in of like, I've done what I can do. That is the best effort I have or best effort I have right now. And it's up to them now. And that's then being able to let that go.
Yeah.
Because you've done your best and that's all you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the most fascinating thing that I have come across with this mode of therapy. And I think everyone should do it at some point, because we all have crap that we deal with in our lives. But this has been absolutely awesome to talk about, because people who actually know about neuromuscular therapy, I feel like, is few and far between. So I was so excited to come and talk to you about this, because I've been so interested in it for so long.
How can people get a hold of you?
They can email me, direlandcmt@gmail.com. There's also my cell phone. It's always on. You can find me on Facebook, all of those things.
And you're in Petaluma, California?
I am in Petaluma, California.
And you practice for yourself?
Practice for myself.
Awesome. Well, you guys get at him if you need some work done, if you want some more information on this. As always, if you guys can follow on their whatever podcast platform you're listening on, like, share, give us a rating if you can. Thank our sponsor, Nine Realms Athletics, ninerealmsathletics.com. Use promo code MANIFEST for a discount on your next order. And as always, we love your guys' suggestions. So if you have somebody you want us to talk to who has an inspirational story that would be great to share, if you know someone who has information on a subject that you think would be beneficial to help change people's lives, shoot us an email, DM, text message. I always say, if I'm in the gym, you see me, talk to me. Probably have to hit me with something, because my music's on super loud and I'm usually in the zone. David, thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to share what I can for this.
Yeah, thank you.
Awesome, guys. Well, thank you. We'll catch you on the next episode.
Later.